be in that respect. We're going through that process this year. As part of that process, we have a survey of staff and of students. So the student survey is there. It's completely anonymous. We'd very much like as many as possible to participate in it. You'll have to realize it's a generic kind of survey because there's only so much you can do. We can't tailor it to every individual person. So some of the questions may or may not apply to somebody who's in first year of university, but certainly I think first year should have a voice. Not just females, by the way. There's this, you know, anybody can interact with the survey. I'd very much encourage you to have a go. It's one way of getting a little bit of voice. And Athena Swan is listened to. So the way it works with Athena Swan, it's not just one of these things where you put in a survey and then nothing happens. Because the way Athena Swan works is that you put in to get one level of accreditation, you want to get another. You have to live up to the things that you said you would do based on the data you collected in order to make those claims or to spot those weaknesses. So it is something that does have an impact. It's not just a random survey. So I would encourage you to do that. Take a note of the URL if you would. I may mail around Informatics One folk just with the URL just to remind you. That's okay. Won't clog up your mailboxes too much. It's an important thing to do. So that's it for the unless anybody wants to ask me anything about that, which is fine. Good. Okay. Oops, sorry. So on to the technical stuff. I want to talk a little bit more about natural deduction proofs using sequent calculus. So it follows on from the lecture yesterday. I want to talk a little bit about how you extend your proofs to deal with negation, because negation is a little bit tricky to deal with in some circumstances. I want to give you just a little bit of an intuition for what the issues are there. The other thing that I want to do is to get you to show you one way that you can extend a set of proof rules. Remember, in the last lecture, I gave you a set of proof rules. I said, oh, here's a set of proof rules. They're not complete. You might extend them for different tasks and so on and so forth. So we're going to be doing that this time to deal with negation. I'll also be talking about closed world negation, which is a special case that's kind of interesting, especially for people who do programming and do logic programming. So I think it's quite a nice one to talk about. And I want to talk a little bit about the limitations of closed world negation. Okay. But first, the problem, the standard problem that I use at the beginning of each talk. And the standard problem this time is perceptrons. And this is, the reason I included this example is because it's really not the sort of thing that you think of talking about in a lecture on logic. I can't really think of anything that's much further away from the sort of mechanics of logic than a perceptron. So, and the reason why is because perceptrons were one of the kind of most fundamental things that were invented when people were trying to study whether you could build models that were biologically inspired with the neurons in a human brain. And of course, this sort of model is a very, very primitive model, but it was one of the early ones that was used for that purpose. And maybe it's worth explaining a little bit about this because it's so different from the normal sort of thing that people would think about in, say, computer science. So a lot of the interest in that sort of modeling came out of the artificial intelligence community. So people who are interested in, could you build systems that were somehow behaved the same, or if you believe in strong artificial intelligence, could do all the things that humans could do, exhibit the same sort of intelligence in every respect. Because a huge stretch goal, nobody's anywhere near that yet. But then, suppose you want to head in that direction. So you don't necessarily believe you'll ever reach there, but you want to head in that direction. Well, there's different things you could do. If you're kind of pure logician, you might say, well, what we want to do is we want to be able to model cognition. We want to understand how people think. What's a good language for expressing how people think? Oh, logic, because from the ancient Greek times, that's what they used to try to model how people think. That's one way, and lots of people do that. If you look back through the literature, you find all sorts of stuff where people are building logical models of human cognition. And a lot of them are very interesting in their different ways. However, a lot of those models have difficulty with things that seem like they should be easy. In particular, Some of them have difficulty with basic forms of learning, the sort of adaptive stuff that I'm doing now. Just I don't know. There's lots of kind of involuntary things I'm doing, waving my hands around, standing up, holding on to this thing without, all this stuff that you just do. Or the kind of leaps of intuition that you make when you're learning from things. You know, if I'm looking across at you, and maybe next time I see some of you, I'll remember that face. Hard to encode that in logic directly in some practical way. So all of these things were kind of pushing folk away from thinking about logic for those kinds of things. So what could you do? If you can't really get much traction in symbolically representing those kinds of things with logic, what could you do? And so people started to experiment with, so then people start looking at the biological system. They say, okay, well, obviously it's using this thing between our ears, and it's made of this gray goo, which if you look inside it is basically a whole bunch of interconnections. Could something that was purely electronic and had all of those sort of interconnections give you interesting behaviors, interesting adaptations? Would it be able to learn, and so on? And a perceptron is kind of the simplest unit of study there. So the biological metaphor that people are exploiting for perceptrons is there's a neuronal type link, and here are all the connections. Of course, nowadays we think, oh, that's terribly simplistic biologically. I mean, actually, even here, you can find research that's been on the go looking at how you can have more complex models. Actually, in here we have the UK Doctoral Training Centre for Neuroinformatics, the only one in the UK. So we do lots of this sort of stuff in great depth. And this is, you know, considered really quite primitive. Still, it's a good thing to look at. So here's how a perceptron works. You think about it in terms of, here's your perceptron, and all that thing really does is it has a little threshold function inside it, and it takes inputs, and the inputs are going to be stimulated. Okay, they're on or they're off, and it produces in this case one output, and it has another special input coming in here that's influencing what the threshold is. So each one can have a different threshold potentially, and each one of these inputs has a weight. The biological analogy is you have a brain, you have these various nodes connecting the neural elements that are firing away in your brain, and these little nodes sit there until they get enough inputs firing away strongly enough, given the different weights on those inputs, in order to fire their output. And when that output fires, it goes on to the next, and the activation spreads. Which is the kind of common thing a lot of you have maybe seen pictures of spreading activation in the brain, that sort of thing. Now, of course, I'm not saying it's as simple as this. It certainly is not. I mean, a lot of the research that's been done here explains why it's not. For example, the connections aren't the only thing. Synapses matter. The complexity of a synapse is very important. We now know. So this is not a plausible biological model. But actually, what turned out to be true was that even though this isn't a plausible biological model, models that look a bit like this have turned out to be quite useful in engineering. So you have neural networks now in cars and all sorts of things where what you have is a kind of control type problem, and you want to make some decision based on whatever the available evidence is. They're really good. These sorts of things are really, not this particular, not just an individual one, but systems of these are really good where what you have is a problem where you can't write down in logic or any other language what the algorithm is. So if I have something where I want to, I don't know, do face recognition or something, I can't very easily write down in logic or as an algorithm how it is I recognize every face. But I might be able to recognize lots of examples of faces, and I might be able to train something to recognize faces, if I had some way of allowing it to be trained. Right? So another good example of this, and actually, come to think of it, I think it's public knowledge now. You know the Xbox, where the detects movement. It's kind of like that. Right? So it's not quite a neuronal system in the Xbox, but it's a machine learning system in the Xbox. What it does is it's able very easily to recognize postures. And it does that in actually quite a brutally direct way, but it works really quite well. The guy who invent it. One of the key algorithms that goes in, there's a guy called Andrew Blake, who did his PhD here. He's now in Microsoft Research. This university is going to give him an honorary degree in the winter graduations. That's an example of something that's at industrial scale, uses these kinds of learning systems for problems where it would be hard to write the algorithm. The guys in the Xbox would find it very hard to write an algorithm that would be able to detect, you know, arbitrary postures and movements. But they can write something that will learn it, and that's what these systems are for. So that was a long story, but worth understanding that there are many, many different ways of skinning the cat when you're trying to build a computational system, and building a learning system is one of them. Right. Okay, so here's a perceptron. Some set of weighted inputs, an output, and a threshold. So then here's how it works. The output here is this threshold function applied to the sum of the weighted inputs minus the threshold. And that function is going to give you zero if this thing is less than or equal to zero, and it's going to give you a one if it's greater than zero. So basically what that says to you is if the inputs here, if you're getting very little activation below the threshold, not enough to trigger the threshold function here, then this is going to still be deactivated. It's going to be a zero. Zero means deactivated. Then if the inputs get activated, and they're all different weights, if you get enough activations in here with the right weights to take this above the threshold, then this is going to go ping and activate. And then you get the spreading activation because its output will go to some other neuron, right? Okay. The threshold is a function? TH here is a function that's applied to this sum. Okay, and then this sum is whatever this is with all the weights minus the threshold. So then once this exceeds the threshold, then this will be greater than zero and that will be one. And if this is below the threshold, then this will be less than zero and that will be that the outcome of that will be zero. That's how it works. Okay. So here's how you train a perceptron. You're never going to be examined on this. Congratulations. So you can relax. Just understand how perceptrons work. Isn't it nice on a Friday afternoon to understand how perceptrons work? This is good. Okay, so here's how you train them. You train them from data. We're coming on to bits where you do need to, so don't fall asleep or anything. But this is just, it's good for you to get anything. So here's how it works, actually. Here's how you train a perceptron. You just pick, because you want them to learn, right? And you don't know what the threshold values are, and you don't know what the weights are at the beginning, right? How could I know how to assign the weights to learn the right behaviors? Because I haven't given it any examples yet. So you have to train it. So what you do is you choose the thresholds and the weights randomly. Just pick some within some range. And then if you're getting the right behavior, so you give it lots of examples. Suppose it's faces we're detecting. This probably wouldn't work with one perceptron, but just imagine. Yeah, you're giving it faces to detect, and you give it some ones of the right kind. I don't know, we won't be able to detect people with mustaches or something. And, you know, something, the right kind. And you see whether it's giving you a yes at the right time. It's activating when you've got the right ones. Okay, and if it is, you were lucky enough to select the right weights and thresholds, bingo, then you stop. That's it, that's the termination. Otherwise, it isn't. There are some examples that aren't working. Then you do this. You choose an example of the wrong output. And if that output's too big, you multiply each input by a small constant and subtract that from the weight, and you increase the threshold by the same. And if the output's too small, you add to the weights and decrease the threshold. Are you just, oh yes. Mm-hmm. It depends on what it's for. You need to be very careful, and I would say, you need to be very careful when somebody says, will this thing work in some domain? Because for these kind of learning systems, there's no such thing, I've ever heard of, as a sort of generic learning system. There are generic algorithms, but then what you need to do for any given learning task, you need to see whether the algorithm actually fits the task. Right? So for neural systems, for example, there'll be some kind of tasks which they're useful for. So certainly some of these are related to online learning. So for example, I'm stretching a bit now. I'm not absolutely sure what precisely it links into, but if I don't know if you're aware of the massive open online content stuff that Stanford and Edinburgh is now involved in doing, pushing out courses online, just for people generically to do, at no cost, just because it's a good idea to push the knowledge out. Those involve examinations. Some of those examinations are using learning systems to be able to spot what are the, for example, in the social network stuff connected with that, to spot what are the typical types of questions that people will want to ask and what the typical answer should be. That would be an example of this in online learning. And so what you have there is a very big and complex social process, but you have a little bit of learning stuck in at just the right bits to help make it go. Lots and lots of systems are like that. People who are very good systems architects are very good at thinking that sort of thing. Question? You're going to subvert my lecture. This is terrible.
That's okay. I've recently heard that, that essentially elevators, modern elevators, how they work is they run for like a week and they don't have any passengers, but after they run for the week, they sort of they have, I would assume, perceptrons within them that sort of teach them, I guess you could say, the most efficient routes on using in an elevator shaft. So how exactly would the whole sort of choosing example of a wrong output work in that case? Is it just a machine doing that by itself? Or?
Yeah, so for systems, you need to be a little bit, so again, I'm going to give you a slightly more subtle answer than you're looking for. So the subtle answer is, for something like a lift, it might be a neural system, it might be something slightly different, which is a fuzzy system. Quite a lot of things like lifts, cameras, and so on, they'll use something that's called a fuzzy logic, which actually, that's closer to logic, actually, although I don't think I'll have time. If I have time, I'll talk to you about that in the lectures. I do have a little time at the end. But what a fuzzy logic is something that acts a bit like these systems, but it thresholds on the, it has various thresholds for the logical connectives. And depending on what those are, then it'll give you a slightly different behavior. I'm finessing this because I have to explain very quickly. And so that's not quite as open-ended as maybe a neural network would be, because you can bring in some of the control theory from the lift into it. And then the issue is probably just to adjust those thresholds with the behavior of the lift. And probably there'll be nothing, I hope, sort of critical to the operation of the lift that's affected by that, but it might affect its behavior and where it stops between floors, for example, or whether it goes, when it's got passengers at a certain thing, how often, you know, whether it goes up or down and those sorts of things. And that's the sort of problem where you can train, because you can have plenty of examples. The most important thing for these systems that need to be trained is you have a nice homogeneous set of examples, and there's some reasonable hope that after you've seen enough of them, you've got the basic properties of the system are there, and there aren't too many basic properties to consider. So lift would be one, but there's just lots of them. I mean, I don't know, if you're browsing on the web and you use Microsoft Bing, for example, that uses machine learning systems. I mean, I know that's a bit, you would be probably using Google, but where are you using Microsoft Bing? What you would find is that it's quite adaptive. And if you were to look under the hood of that, you would find learning algorithms. We part employ one of the guys that designed that. It's Chris Bishop. He spends most of his time down in Microsoft Research in Cambridge, but he spends part of his time with us. So that's another big example where people use it. Well, most of those learning things, they're almost behind the scenes. I don't know, if you use Apple and you work with Photos and you do that funny thing with the face recognition, it's a learning system behind that. We don't have anything to do with that. Okay, so that's what this, the important thing about this is, if you keep doing this, it turns out that if it can converge, it will. Don't ask me to give a proof of that, actually I never tried, but that's the received reason. So the question is, could we take perceptrons and make them behave like logic? That's the problem for you. So if I wanted to take a perceptron, just one of them, just one single perceptron, and make it, turn it into something that would be an element in a logic circuit, could I do that? Could I turn it back into something that gave me logic of the sort that we've seen before, ands and ors and that sort of thing? So that's something to think about. We'll come back to it at the end if there's time. But first, you need negation. So I'm going to give you two forms of negation. And the first one is harder than the second one in my first one is is a little harder at the beginning than the second one, and the second one is easier at the beginning and harder at the end. So you'll see why. Okay, so remember all the proof rules we had in the last lecture. I'm not going to give you them again, but you remember the concept of a proof rule. You have something on the left, which is the thing you want to prove, something on the right that's going to be the subproofs that you do. So the idea is that I can prove this if I can prove these things. And sometimes you have more than one of these. And things on the right kind of decompose the problem of proving something into hopefully smaller tasks. Of course, you end up having choice in how you apply these rules, so you don't necessarily, so you have some choices to make when you're doing the proof. And if you make the wrong choice, you may not get a proof even though it's there to be got. So there is an issue of search when you're looking for these proofs. Okay, so imagine you've got all the ones we saw in the last lecture, which I won't give you again, but then we want to deal with negation. And I'm going to introduce a slightly strange thing here, this special symbol, which I'll call false. And what false means is I've proved something contradictory. And really, all it's doing is setting up this one here. So if I want to show from some set of axioms that A is not true, then what I want to do is that stuff in A as an assumption, like we did last time. Remember, this is the one that just this is the operator that just adds in something to my set of axioms. And I want to show that it gives me a contradiction. It isn't really important that I call this false. It's some other symbol that it's not going to appear anywhere else that represents a contradiction. And here's how I'm really going to get to establish the contradiction. So this is the one that actually is going to do the real work for me. This says, from some set of axioms, I can establish anything at all if not A is in that set of axioms. So I know the negation is in there. And from that set of axioms, I can establish A. In other words, I know A is not true, but then I can also establish A. That would be a contradiction, right? If I say the sky is blue and the sky is not blue, that's contradictory. Right? So notice this is just finding negation and this is proving the contrary. This one allows me to unpack knots. So this one says if I can prove that it's not true, that A is not true. This goes the other way, from proving a double negation to proving it's the positive. So if I say it's not true that the sky is not blue, then that's the same as saying that the sky is blue. Right? I mean, if you've got a two-valued logic, which all of these logics are two-valued, there are plenty of logics in the world that aren't two-valued, in which case you can get much, much finer shades of description. I mentioned a little bit about that at the very first lecture. But all the logics I'm talking about at the moment have two values. Things are either true or false. There is no in-between. So here's a proof tree for this. Suppose I want to prove that if A is true and it's not true that A and B are true, then B is not true. So not B follows from these two axioms. Here's what I do. So I try to show that with B in here and A, and it's not true that A and B is true, I can get false. And then, using the second of those rules, I say, okay, can I find something, anything in here that gives me a contradiction? Okay, so if I can show that this is contradictory anywhere inside it, and remember, I just put B inside there, right? If I can show anywhere inside here with any combination of things that I have a contradiction, I'll get my conclusion. So then I look for not of anything inside here, and there's not A and B inside here. And then I try to prove the contrary, which is A and B, right? So if I can show that not A and B appears in here, which it does, and then I can show that I can prove A and B from here, I have a contradiction. So now I try and prove A and B from all of this. From this I can prove A directly. And for this, I can prove B directly, because B's in there. I should probably have another step that does the set membership thing if I was being completely consistent with what I said yesterday. but that's just a trivial step, right? So I'm not really too worried at the moment whether you can kind of do these kind of proofs. You get a bit of practice in doing this sort of thing. The most important thing for our current purposes is what's going on here. All of this is positive, right? It means that what I'm doing is I have some rules that enable me to work through this tree, and I search through it in a normal way, and after a search using the rules, I prove something that's a negation. And I would make, if I were being careful about my rules, I'd argue for each one of them being able to give me a correct proof at every step, but we won't go into that. Okay, so that's one way. Oh, sorry, these ones come in. Okay, so there's another way that you can do it. So that was the one that I said would be a little bit difficult at the beginning and then easy at the end. It's difficult at the beginning because you have to understand the proof rules a little bit, but it's easy at the end because we're doing the same thing as we did last time in the lecture, right? I just gave you another set of proof rules and you followed them through and a life is great. This one is sort of easy at the beginning but more difficult at the end. So this is the simple thing I could do that people actually do. If you're a logic programmer and use languages like Prolog, which I'll show you later on because it's nice to see a bit of programming, actually do. You take all the previous negation rules, and I'll give you just one, but with a new operator in here. So I'll give you a proof of not whatever it is, A, from my set of axioms, if, and this one means, with a little red bar through it, means I do my best and I search all I can exhaustively with all the proof rules I've got and all the axioms I can access through that proof rule. I just blitz through all of those and I can't find a proof. I searched everywhere and I couldn't find it. So it's a bit like you're looking for your car keys in the morning and you search everywhere and you can't find them. And therefore you assume your car keys can't be in your house and you look somewhere. That's it, right? Okay? So you just can't find a proof from it. And this makes use of what's called the closed world assumptions. What that means is that we're assuming here that my set of axioms has all the axioms that are pertinent to the problem. So I haven't missed an axiom at, for example. And it also assumes that the way I'm searching the proof is complete. That I have all my proof rules. If I did, you know, apply them all exhaustively and make all the choices that I could and go back and look at different options and so on, build all the proof trees that I could possibly build, those are all that I could ever possibly legitimately want. So it assumes that of your proof system. And it's astonishingly effective, actually. It is the basis for much of practical logic programming. It's this one simple little rule. Here's a closed world proof. We've not got to the difficult bit yet. So here's a closed world proof. And this time I put some variables in because I just thought it was nice for you to see something with variables in. And actually for the next bit, which is the slightly more difficult bit, I need variables. So this goes a little bit beyond propositional logic, which is good news for you because you won't get asked any questions that go beyond propositional logic in the exam. So you need to understand the notion of closed world, which I just described, and negation is failure. But you don't need to understand this particular proof. So here we go. I want to prove that Q of C is not true, and my axioms are P of A, P of B, and if P of X is true, then Q of X is true. Right? And so I want to show from that it's not true that Q of C is true. And kind of you can see it already, maybe, if you take a bit of time, because you can kind of see that I've got P of A and P of B, and the only way of getting Q of X is through P of X, so I'm only ever going to get Q of A and Q of B, so I couldn't get Q of C, right? Assuming, closed world assumption, that this is a complete description. Okay, so let's see how it works. So what I say is, let's try and show to do that. I apply my rule, which says not Q of C is true if I can't find a proof of Q of C from these same axioms. So I try to find a proof of Q of C, and I search exhaustively. At this point, you're going to have to trust me that I am searching exhaustively. So the only way I can prove Q of C is through this axiom, right? So I find P of C if Q of C is in here, and then I try and prove P of C, which was one of the proof rules from the previous lecture. I think it was either the one on the bottom or the one third from the bottom in your list if you're looking at it. So I try to prove P of C now, which is the precondition for the implication, from the same set of axioms. I can't. Okay, I won't give you all of this, but what I would have to do is to look at P of A isn't true, P of C isn't true from P of A, it isn't true from P of B. There's nothing else that allows me to conclude P of C. This is not going to work. So that one doesn't work. This little red bit here means it failed. So that fails, that fails, and that fails. Oh, sorry. And so that succeeds. The failure of this means that this one succeeds. Right? I failed to find evidence to the contrary, therefore the negation must be true. Which is neat. This bit you definitely don't have to remember. This is the nasty bit. So actually, it turns out you need to be very careful about this. And how many of you actually have done logic programming? How many have done Prolog? A few. Yes, about half a dozen or 10 or something. Okay. So if you do a lot of Prolog programming, then occasionally you come up against this issue. Issues a bit like this. So here's something where I want to prove from P of A and Q of B that P of X is true and not Q of X is true. Is that true or false using the closed world assumption? Well, let's do the proof. So let's choose it this way around. So I say, okay, let's see if from P of A and Q of B, if P of X is true, and then let's see if from P of A and Q of B, not Q of X is true. So we go down, and we have P of A appears in P of A and Q of B. So I could satisfy this one with X being A, right? Very importantly, that's P of A, right? So that X here should be A, right? So it's A. And that's A, and that's A, right? If you're doing this as a logic programmer, right? Because you found an instance for the X, it was A, right? And now that's also A. So now I'm going to try and prove, is it not true for Q of A? So I should see, is it the case that I can't find a proof for Q of A? It's not. So that means that that fails, which means that that succeeds, right? So that's true, right? Happy? No. So now let's try it the other way around. So not Q of X and P of X. So I've just taken the and twisted it the other way around. And of course, that shouldn't make any difference, right? Because saying A and B is the same as saying B and A, and is symmetrical. So let's have a go, and we do the same thing. So this time, we'll do not Q of X from this. And then I try to prove from this. So you see, if I can't find a proof of Q of X, I can find a proof of Q of B. So that means that that one fails. This one succeeds, so that one must fail. So that one fails, and that one fails. So that can't be good, because that was true, and all I did was change the order here, and that one was false. I told you it was going to get nasty. So that's a particularly, the reason I put this one in is not because I want you to remember it, but because I want to give you a kind of practical example of why you have to be a little bit sneaky when you use things like closed world assumption and so on in proofs. It's not always the case that you're able to discharge those assumptions given the proof strategy that you decide to use. You need to be very careful. In fact, if we were doing an entire course on something like logic programming, then I could tell you all of the different ways that logic programmers go about avoiding this kind of problem, and there are many ways of doing that. It's not pathological or anything. But what I'm showing you is, if you're not careful, you hit these kind of insidious little logic problems. The reason we get a logic problem here is because in this case, when we were doing the Q of X, it was a variable. In that case, when we found the instance for the A, for the X here, this one was forced to be the same, and then we weren't doing the same proof, actually, down that branch, as we did when we chose the Q of X first. So you need to actually, what it is you need to be very careful with the quantification of the variables when you're doing this kind of proof. But don't worry about that. Just understand that negationist failure applies a closed world assumption. The closed world assumption is something you need to be careful to watch. Okay, so nearly done, and then I'll let you out into the sunshine on a Friday afternoon. Perceptrons. Okay, so if we want to answer our perceptron question, being thoroughgoing good logicians, what we're going to do is we're going to represent it in a logic. So here we are. Let's represent all the weights in our logic. I'll vary the weights from -2 to +2. Why not? Let's do that. And the thresholds from -2 to +2. Those are arbitrary choices, but they work out quite nicely for this example. And I'll just say I'll give you various values for them from -2, -1.9, -1.8, and so on all the way up to 2. So those are your axioms for weights. For thresholds, same sequence of axioms there. Input 0 and 1. That's the sort of thing you'd put in your set of axioms to do your proofs from. And here's the axiom that determines what a perceptron is, what a perceptron's behavior is. So perceptron here takes an input set of these guys, the inputs and the weights. It takes your threshold, and it gives you an output. So actually, if you're doing functional programming, in some ways, this is acting like a function. The input set, the threshold, and it gives you the output. But of course, since we're working with logics rather than horrendously limited functional programming. No, I shouldn't say that. Functional programming is great. Not as good as logic, but it's great. Then we make this dependent on finding the sum of weights for the inputs, and that gives us S. So this also is operating like a function. Give it a set of inputs with their weights. I haven't really said what this looks like because I'm saving a bit of effort here, but it would be a sequence of pairs, input and weight. And then you do the calculation that works out how to evaluate the threshold function, which that's sum minus the threshold, if you remember. And then you do the one that says whether E is the resulting number is less than or equal to 0, in which case the output is 0, or is greater than or equal to 0, in which case it's 1. That's all. So that defines for you what a perceptron is. So whenever this is true, this must be true. Okay. And now we say what behavior we require for the perceptron. And so I can do that just with a bunch of axioms. I say for an AND perceptron. So here's the truth table. Hey, you haven't seen a truth table for at least one lecture. So this is exactly the same. Here's a truth table for two inputs. Input 1, input 2. And instead of true or false, I'll do 0 and 1. Right? So let's just imagine 0 is false and 1 is true, let's imagine. But really, it's unactivated and activated. So here's an AND. You get an AND. If both are activated, you get a 1. If only 1 is activated, you get a 0. Just like a logical AND. If both are true, you get a true. In any other circumstance, you get false. An OR is kind of the other way around. You only get false if both are false, otherwise you always get true if one of them is true. For negation, it just inverts the symbol. So a not for I1 takes a 0 and turns it into a 1, takes a 1 and turns it into a 0. Okay, that's just your truth table, except instead of true and false, I use 1 and 0. And then I can define my truth table in the logic, which is quite neat, actually. Remember, I'm doing logic as a semantics for truth tables as semantics for logic. I'm using logic to represent truth tables. So that's good. This is what we like to do with logic. So ask a question.
So if you've got some input that isn't necessarily just true or false, it's a gradation, you discretize and then set it to either true or false?
Yeah, so good point, because so the assumption here for perceptrons is things are either activated or not. Mm-hmm. You could have other systems that weren't like that, that were there had some more gradated behavior, that had some, you know, where there's some continuous function, but perceptrons aren't those. They're either activated or they're not. Okay, so this required thing takes 1, 2, 3 arguments, that nature of the connective, so for and a requirement given the activation value for each input and the weight on each input. So actually, it doesn't matter what the weights are. I'm expecting for an and, if I get a 0 for one input, a 0 for another, it to be 0. Same for any of these. If it's the only time I get a 1 as an output, I want to have a 1 and a 1 here. Right? So all this is doing is really encoding the same information that's in here graphically. Or I suppose it's in here graphically because it's relating these. Right? And actually, this is a tiny, I don't usually make this point, but I'll make it this time. This is a tiny example of the sort of thing you do when you're trying to verify things. In some ways, what I'm doing is, back here, I'm building my model of this system, and I do it in logic. And what I'm doing here, really, is I'm saying, here's a requirement that I want that system to possess. This is very common in software engineering, although not often as formally as this. You'll say, I want my system to do this. Please, automated system, or sometimes it's a mixture of automation and manual system, show me that my system has this property. We come on to that, a lot of that later when we do finite state machines. Okay, so now I want to show that I have whether or not the perceptron I've got is a valid perceptron. It's behaving the way I want it to behave, which I haven't said yet. I've said, here's the required behavior, and I've said, here's what a perceptron does, but I haven't linked the two. So this one is going to link the two, and this gets a little bit hairy. You'll never be examined on this. Relax. Just understand what I'm about. You can go back to it and look at the slides or something. So valid perceptron is true exactly when, in all cases, my perceptron is valid with respect to a particular type of connective. So P here would be, if it was the AND one that I'm doing, P would be AND. And W1 and W2 would be the weights for the inputs, so that's just the weights, not the activations, right? And T is the threshold. So I want to know, is the perceptron definition that I've got with these two weights and this threshold a valid one for a particular logical connective? And here's where negation gets used in a sneaky way. I like to give you sneaky ways of using negation. So it says, okay, if I've got a weight W1 and a weight W2, remember I have lots of those in my set of axioms, everything, minus 2 up to +2, lots and lots of them. So I could select any one of these, and I have a threshold. I have lots of those as well, potentially. I'd have to choose which ones. And now here's the other negation. And it's not true that I can find an input. Remember, I have 0 and 1 for both of those, for I1 and input I2. And I have a valid perceptron between those inputs, and it. Here's another not, and it doesn't meet the requirement. And I've defined my requirement for every combination of inputs and outputs. So that should, if you're a normal human being, be making you go, what? So what's going on here? What you're really doing here is saying, is forcing your prover to look exhaustively. So it says, you've got a double negation in here in a sophisticated way. So imagine I just look at this bit in the middle. If I've got an input, if I choose two inputs, and I've got lots of different ones way back here, right? Remember, I've got lots of different weights, potentially lots of different potential inputs. If I choose two of these, and my perceptron works to generate some output, and it's not the required output, it's not a valid perceptron, right? That's true. And so this not says it's not a valid perceptron. So it must be a valid perceptron, given the choice of weights and threshold that I chose. Ah, isn't that lovely? That's how you use negation as failure in a very constructive way. Isn't that lovely? I love my job. Good. So, and actually, just so you know, that works if you, if for example you choose AND with 1, 1, and 1.5, and there are various other ones you could choose. That works. So in other words, for an AND, you have kind of a valid perceptron will give you the behavior. So then you might ask yourself, if I chose some other things, would it work? Would it be true for every kind of logical behavior I could imagine? Could I always build one? So here's one that's not quite the normal logical connective, but it's not far off. Exclusive OR. So you know what normal OR is. Always true, except where both things are false. Exclusive OR isn't quite like that. If both things are false, it's still false. But if both things are true, it's false. So it's true exactly when exactly one of its two constituents is true. So if I said, is A or B true, and both A and B were true, then with normal OR, A or B is true, right? If I said, is A or B true and only A is true, for example, it's also true that A or B is true. With exclusive OR, if I say, is A and exclusive OR B true and only A is true, that's true. If I said, if A and B are both true, is A or exclusive OR true? No, because it doesn't want both of them true, only wants one. Okay, would valid perceptron hold for that? We're running out of time, the answer is no. Later on you'll know enough to be able to actually go away and program this and do it if you really pay attention by the end. That's not required for the course, but you will know enough. Do I have enough time? Very quickly, there's a limit to this because I'm using particular steps. And actually, if you did want to prove that you couldn't get it, the thing you want to look at is linear separability. So actually, if you look at these things for things like ands and ors, if you were to look at the inputs versus each other and look at the cases where it says yes versus cases where it says no, you could separate them on a plane, whereas with exclusive OR, you can't. And actually, that's the basic reason that you can't do that. But I don't have time to really explain that. Don't worry. Here are some things to practice. Try some proofs of the full set of negation rules, just for fun. Don't worry about variables, though, because that's just getting too hard. Try some closed world proofs if you get time as well, just to give a bit of practice. I can do these in the tutorials as well. Sorry I'm cutting it a bit close to the wire, but you still have time to get out. Enjoy the last of the Edinburgh sunshine, if it's still there. See you next time. So the logics that I use here come out of mathematical logic. There is a variant of the logic that I use, which I will show you at the end. And actually, I'll do some programming for you. I don't require you to program, but I'll show you some that is a programming language.
All the proofs in supplements, does that mean that by you, is that actually
formatted learning experiment? So the proofs are just proofs. So I do them by hand. All of them I could do my machine if I wanted to. It's perfectly possible to turn the logic that I've got and turn it into essentially a computer. That's what logic programming does, and I will explain that to you. You won't be examined on it, but I'll make you handle it.
So about the proof that negative programs, so in order to prove negative, you have to just say that the model is not born in a way
that the closed world.
There is necessarily a contradiction because if there isn't any proof for that, there isn't any proof that it's not.
Yeah, so that was kind of the idea with giving these two versions. So in the first version I gave, you have to actually establish the contradiction. You have to spot.
Yeah, yeah.
In the second one, you don't have to have it there. You just have to show that you exhaustively searched and didn't find the contrary, which is a weaker notion of negation. But in programming terms, it's extremely effective. It's the basis of almost all of them. Oh, you mean the handouts? Level 4 of Appleton Tower, and they'll give you the paper handouts. They're also available on the website electronically if you just want to have them electronically.
Yes,
you can find the slides on the web. It'll be, three.
Thank you.
And the video should be on the web as well. I mean, I think maybe even last year's ones may still be there. And these ones, if the machinery works, you'll get them as well. So if you miss a lecture, you should
be able
to find it again.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you so much.
I was wondering, is there any place to find proofs? Practice.
You get them in tutorials. The other thing is that if you're short of practice, there's a bunch of references to books that you could get. I don't require you to do them. That you just buy. I wish I could say to you at the moment, and you can also self-test on WebCT, but we're still porting that stuff across. It's taken a bit longer than I thought. Should be in the fullness of time, you'll be able to get that as well.
The tutorial, but I'm not sure whether I understand it correct. So
it sounds like a job for a tutor.
I know whether I can continue doing it this way.
What do you think that might be an issue?
I'm not sure because I've tried to use those.
There should be a bunch of proof rules.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I don't know whether it's maybe you can.
Let me see. No problem. Let's see. B and C, Andrew. So you're splitting it on the and. A implies B, A implies C. A implies B, B. So then you're putting A and B implies C and B and C and elimination, you get B and C. That sounds, looks right to me. And then you do it this way, you're going to do the same thing then this side. A implies C, A goes in, B and C is true, so you split off the, you're getting the and, assuming you've got something that, let me check if you put your rules they've given you. Wait a minute. Have you got? Oh yeah, you've got this one that allows you to split up the and, so that's okay, probably. It sounds rough. It looks right, roughly right to me. You're certainly doing the right kind of thing.
I spoke to you yesterday about
performance. Ah, you've got it.
Yes, I do have it. Yeah.
Shall I grab it before and then I need to get? Do I just need to sign?
It's this one here.
You don't mind doing
your signature.
Oh, we need to get the stamp, which is in the office. Can you just leave it with me? How soon do you need this back? It's not today, is it?
It's not today. It's just as soon as possible.
Okay. If you leave it with me, then I'll get it back. I'll try and remember to take it back to you with the next lecture due. Otherwise, I'll leave it in the IT office or something.
Okay.
With the next lecture due, or
is that on next Thursday?
It'll be Thursday. I'm guessing. Actually, have you got your? The easiest thing might be if I just give it to Marjorie in the school office, and she'll contact you. Do you have your email? She'll mail you. And then you don't have to wait. It's just she'll contact you when you can collect.
Do you want me to write?
Could you write it on? Yeah, write it in the back if you would, and then I'll take it there. Give it all that. It's just a cloud. Just there. You go.
Okay.
I was wondering if you have the answers for some of that can access the answers for the previous tutorial exercise.
They should go up on the web, aren't they? On the web. Usually what happens, mail Jibei and ask him. So you know the guy's the TA for the course, Jibei, he's a Chinese
right.
guy. You find his address on the website. If the answers aren't up, I think the tutorials were started this week, right?
Yes.
The answers will be out at the end of this week, so I should think.
On the web?
On the web, so
right.
It should be. If you look at the website,
yeah.
What I told them was sometime late on Friday, because I want people to do the tutorials rather than just read the
sure,
answers.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Sometime late on Friday, what you should find is that you'll find a little link to the solution just opposite where the tutorial exercise
oh,
yeah. is.
Right.
That ought to do it. If it doesn't, mail GB, because that means he's forgotten.
Right.
So I thought that I can find some information for you. I went to the IT, but they didn't put me in.
I'll thank you very much. We'll be in touch. You'll get mailed. If you're not mailed, then mail me. It'll mean something screwed up.
Okay, thanks.
Person to mail is actually, it won't be me, it will be Ian Stark, who's the director of teaching. You have a piece of paper, I can write his name for you if you like. Just mail him and ask. Good man, thank you very much. I don't mean to banish you to somebody else, but he will know better than I do. He should be able to answer. Sorry to be bouncing you around between people, but he will.
No, it's no problem. I'll try to find him.
Oh.
Yeah, I understand the problems.
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
Oh, here, if the sequence is false, it's a lie.
Ah, so this false thing, really all this is doing is saying, what I need here
yeah.
is something that indicates something that I expect to be false. So think of this as being like a special symbol that will always be false, that I always want to prove false. And then this bit allows me to prove the negation of something by showing that that I can obtain false from here.
So,
the bit that's possibly where that worries people about this a little bit is, why should I be able to prove anything at all from something that's false?
Yeah.
So, the reason why that's true is because of a kind of property of logics. It's a bit more obvious for me, we're going to talk about resolution proofs later. One of the standard ways of proving something is to show that its negation is contradictory, and from something contradictory,